Sunstone Theological Society presents Revisioning Theology as Care of the Soul, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We're really pleased to have Dr. Moore here. He is our speaker today. I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Moore is an analyst in private practice. His approach to psychology is archetypal, which is an outgrowth of Jungian psychology. He is the author of The Planets Within and Rituals of the Imagination. In his paper, he will distinguish between psychological and spiritual approach to religion. And the title of his paper is Revisioning Theology as Care of the Soul. And without wasting any more time, I'd like to turn the time over to Dr. Moore.
Thank you. Before beginning to read you and talk to you about this paper that I prepared for today, I'd like to tell you just a couple things about my background, because I think it might help to give you an idea of what all this is about. Personally, I spent 10 years in a Roman Catholic monastery in my youth, a long time ago, and since then I've been interested in studying religion and psychology. I have taught Jungian psychology for many years, the work of Carl Jung, and have worked a great deal with training Jungian analysts, but I find I don't like to have to be hemmed in. So I have not, I'm not an analyst myself, not a Jungian analyst. Instead, I work primarily in what we call archetypal psychology. Some of you may know the writings of James Hillman, who is a colleague of mine and friend, and we have worked together for about 12 years. And in fact, right now, one of our major projects, one of mine, is to produce by December 31st a Hillman reader, try to put together the writings of Hillman so we can have archetypal psychology explained in one volume. So what I'm doing here today, this revisioning theology, his care of the soul, is, in a sense, an application of archetypal psychology to religion. One of the things that we do in archetypal psychology is make a distinction that I'm going to be talking about again a little bit later that's not too common, perhaps, and that is the distinction between spirit and soul. I'm going to explain a little bit later what I mean by that, but I want to tell you now that when I use the word soul as in the title of this paper, Care of Soul, I'm not referring to a theological, metaphysical thing. I'm referring to a quality of experience and a quality of person, a quality of things. When we say that something has soul or a person has soul, you might keep that in mind when I use this word. It's a difficult one. We've chosen to keep this word, even though it's difficult, because of the connotations of depth and mystery that are with it. Okay. Revisioning theology as care of the soul. For many centuries, theological, philosophical, and even medical traditions have divided human experience into three parts: body, soul, and spirit. So I get this idea primarily from my studies of Renaissance psychology. The Renaissance Platonists were very interested in the soul and very interested in therapy. And they saw all of experience, the world itself, as divided into body, soul, and spirit. Now, they had a very complicated view of this. At times, they said, sometimes the spirit and body are also contained within soul. But at least that's the basic idea. Usually in the modern world, we imagine experience dualistically as mind and body, or spirit and matter. But dualisms are dangerous. They set up antagonisms, extremes, and literalisms. When we see ourselves as mind and body, we tend to divide ourselves up into competing and controlling parts. We try to achieve mind control, mind over matter. We want to figure things out, get on top of them, conquer them with intelligence. In reaction, we take an anti-intellectual approach, sometimes, in body and feelings. Psychology frequently gets caught in these disasters of dualistic thinking. Just think about it. There are psychologies that are extremely intellectual, in that sense, spiritual, and some that are completely mindless. And in fact, if you if you use your mind at all, you're considered to be rather unhealthy in some of these psychologies. So we have these two sides. Now, religion and theology are usually imagined from the viewpoint of spirit. We want to know the truth. We want a foolproof guide to morality. We want to ensure happiness in this world and beyond, with gradations of these ideas. But I want to suggest ways of imagining religion from a different point of view, as a phenomenon of the soul. One advantage of this point of view is that we can then preserve our spiritual concerns without ignoring our psychological needs. Now, when I use the word psychological here, I'm using it as an adjective of the soul. You know, the Greek word for soul was psyche or psyche. The word psychology means the logos of the soul, means the nature, the logos, the deepest meaning of soul. That's what psychology as a word means. Psychotherapy means to be an attendant on the soul. Psyche therops means to be an attendant or nurse of the soul. In fact, there's a passage in Plato. I feel myself digressing here, but I think we have time for some of these. There's a passage in Plato where Socrates is asked, what is the meaning of therapeia? Because if you read Plato as a psychologist or with a psychological ear, everything in Plato is about psyche, about the soul, and about therapy. So anyway, Socrates is asked what therapy is, and he says, it is the service of the gods. And the questioner says, well, what do you mean by service? And he says, whatever a maid or a butler does. So with Socrates and Plato in mind, psychotherapy means to be the servant, the maid, the butler, the attendant or nurse of the soul, psychotherapy. So in our work, in archetypal therapy, our concern is always the soul as it presents itself, not the person we're working with, not ourselves, not the relationship, but the soul of that encounter. Now, another advantage of looking at religion and theology from the point of view of soul is that then we may stand a chance of glimpsing the shadow of spirituality. Those qualities of spirit which, left unchecked, can be harmful and destructive. Spirituality is so pure, so inherently well-intentioned and good, that it is difficult to notice its blind spots, its holes and gaps, its exaggerations and extremes. There's a special kind of spiritual unconsciousness, you might say. It's not easy to glimpse the shadow of spirit. Now, I'm using shadow in that Jungian sense, meaning the dark underside, the side of something that we'd rather not look at, the part that is hidden because we emphasize certain other things. So I'm interested in the shadow of our spirituality. And looking at religion and theology from the point of view of soul, we might be able to get a glimpse of some of our own shadow that is there as we practice our spiritual work. Now, I always find it helpful to have an image to guide me into reflection on the soul. You know, Jung said that psyche is image. It's exactly how psyche presents itself. So let me begin with a story from the Jewish Midrash, or commentary on the scriptures, that is recounted by Jung in his alchemical writings. So here's a story to Jung, but comes from Midrash. At the time when David was still tending the sheep, he went and found a unicorn asleep in the desert. And thinking it was a mountain, he climbed to the top and pastured his flock there. Then the unicorn shook himself and stood up. David rode on his back and reached up to heaven. And in that hour, David spoke to God. If thou wilt take me down from this unicorn, I will build thee a temple, 100 cubits in size, like the horn of this unicorn. Interesting. This is halfway through the story. Interesting. David isn't up there too long, and he wants to come down. And also notice the parallel between the unicorn horn and temple. Now, to continue the story. What did the Holy One, blessed be He, do for David? He ordained that a lion should come. And when the unicorn saw the lion, he was afraid and crouched down before him, because the lion is his king. And David descended to the earth. But when David saw the lion, he was afraid. Therefore it is said, this is a line from the Psalms, save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast freed me from the horns of the unicorns. That's either a comic story or a very mysterious, obscure one, not sure which, maybe both. At any rate, David has a problem. It's either unicorns or lions, and he doesn't like either one. And he prays to God to be saved from both. This is one of the many unicorn stories Jung tells in his alchemical studies. Today we're familiar with the unicorn from inspiring greeting cards and uplifting paintings and drawings. You've seen them in the stores, right? This modern unicorn is much like the imaginal beast of the Middle Ages and Renaissance, who even then was considered a paragon of purity, health, and beauty. In fact, in Renaissance times, apothecary shops had a unicorn horn outside of them. You know, you could always spot one, just like you can tell a barber's pole today. A unicorn horn was a sign of an apothecary. So if you needed some medicines and something to help you out, especially if you wanted to prevent being poisoned, you put a little bit of unicorn horn in your drink. I might recommend that sometime. Just a little unicorn powder in your drink, and you won't have any troubles at all. Now, the unicorn's single, uplifted, tapering horn clearly inspires fantasies of wholeness, health, single-mindedness, monotheism, perfection, and upward striving. I mean, just think about it, the beauty of that single unicorn horn. This is not even saying a thing about Freudian interpretations of it. This is the wonderful uplifting image of the unicorn horn. And of course, this can tend toward a certain kind of sentimentality. I was speaking to some art students in Boston last week. We were looking for some illustrations for a brochure, and they said, whatever you do, don't use rainbows and unicorns. It's not that they're not wonderful, it's just a little overused, and maybe a little too bright. Now, the Midrash story says that the unicorn was a mountain. The height of mountains, this is a good place to talk about this. I can't talk about this so well in New England where I live. The height of mountains, their retreat from earthly conditions, and their vanishing in the air make them a perfect image of a certain kind of spirituality. Moses talked to God on a mountain, and Jesus spoke his beatitudes from a mountain. Some go off to mountaintops in Tibet to find spiritual wisdom, and others, like David, are inspired to build soaring temples as tangible representations of spiritual conviction. As the Midrash says, the temple itself is a unicorn. These cathedrals and temples are, to use a phrase from T.S. Eliot, they're objective correlatives. Something out there in the world that correlates to something felt inside. An objective correlative of the spiritual values that we feel inside. So you might say that we ourselves have the unicorn. Every once in a while I hear a dream from somebody about a unicorn. It's rather rare. But whenever someone has a unicorn dream, you just can't hold them down. It feels so good. It's like flying dreams. You know, most people feel very good after a flying dream. So the ascent itself, that inward ascent, going up like the mountain, is a very good positive feeling, but it has its shadow. Otherwise, David would have stayed up there. Notice that the story says that David rode on the back of this unicorn mountain and reached up to heaven. The unicorn spirit is a means of ascent, a going up in thought and feeling, a soothing transcendence of earth and its beasts. But reaching so high can also be a problem. Greek mythology tells the story of the boy Bellerophon, who wanted to climb high in the back of the winged horse Pegasus so he could overhear the whispered conversations of the gods. How many of us have similar ambitions, wishing to know mysteries that lie beyond human capacity, searching for some way to rise above the conditions of ordinary human life? Bellerophon was tossed by the horse and came down tumbling. This is the problem of flying. The higher you fly, the worse the fall is. And we have all kinds of stories in mythology, especially Greek mythology, all kinds of stories of boys, this boyish spirit that wants to get up there, very ambitious, very spiritual in that sense, wants to get as high as possible. And down they come. Icarus comes falling down. Phaethon comes falling down. Bellerophon's falling down. The boys are always falling down off their high places. And people dream about these things. A very familiar dream motif is that it has the dreamer high up on a ladder, or high on a roof of a house, or high on a rickety staircase. In the past few months, I have heard a dream of someone standing very precariously on top of a mast on a boat. Just imagine what that would be like, standing on top of the mast as the boat's going along. Kind of uneasy up there. I also recently heard a dream of someone who was on one of these ski trams or gondolas, way up there on a wire, on top of the tram, trying to hang on. This movement up high, without much grounding and not much to hang on to, is not easy to handle. Now, apparently, David felt vertigo, the kind of vertigo that can accompany spiritual ambition. In fact, if I were to write a book on spiritual guidance, I'd want a chapter on vertigo. You know, the advantage, actually, of feeling that sense of being so high, not being able to get a hold of the ground or some kind of grounding where you can feel secure up there. All right, back to the story. David then offered a prayer, comment on the story, offered a prayer that could well be the verse of my talk today. Lord, this unicorn is too high. Help me get back down to earth. God answered his prayer, but in a very strange way. He managed to have a lion appear before the unicorn and strike fear into this white horned beast. But then, although the lion helped David get back to earth, David was also afraid of it. Save me from the lion's mouth, the psalm says, for you have freed me from the horns of the unicorns. Now, Jung's reading of this meeting of lion and unicorn can get us started in our search for a soul-centered sense of theology and religion. The two animals, says Jung, battle each other. That's the lion and the unicorn. David is caught between two dangers, one that is too lofty, one that is too earthly. Oddly, in some ways, they are the same beast. In stories, one sometimes substitutes for the other. And we get confused sometimes whether we're dealing with the teeth of spirit or the teeth of the soul. It's kind of sometimes hard to know just where we are there. In alchemy, they both represent the mysterious spirit called Mercurius, Mercury. In alchemy, Mercury is that substance that gets things going. It's there at the beginning and there at the end. And if any of you are Gemini, have a sense of yourself, you know that mercurial quality is also ambivalent, double. So the lion and the unicorn are a little bit like Mercury there. They're like each other. Spirit is frightening because it can wound the soul. Soul is frightening because it takes us down into the misty depths that can be confusing and overwhelming. Most of the people I talk to about it say they have never considered a difference between soul and spirit, between the lion and the unicorn in this Midrash imagery. How can you separate soul work from spirituality, they ask. Well, you don't have to separate them, but you can make some distinctions. Spirit soars and likes to take a stance over and above ordinary life. It seeks transcendence. It wants to know truth altogether. It wants to know about death and afterlife. It loves miracles as a way around the laws of nature. It strives for a simple moral code that is clear and worthy, that can offer a moral assurance and security. Like the spirited Bellerophon, it hungers for intimacy with the divine. It favors fasting, meditating, lofty music, sacred costume, all ways of getting some distance on mundane life. Now, Renaissance theologians considered these elements of spirits very positively and said that spirit is necessary for the soul. They said that spirit is the food of the soul. The food. Jung frequently refers to traditions, especially Gnostic writings, that describe spirit as a seed that makes the soul fertile. He uses a strange phrase, the spermatic word of spirit, a sperm-like quality to spirit. It seeds, makes fertile. It's true, isn't it, that something in the soul tends toward unconsciousness and therefore requires spiritual seeding. We might rather bathe in narcissistic self-absorption than to shape and firm up our ethical sensibilities, for example. It is also easy to live a life of mere survival with no concern for meaning, values, and self-knowledge. In Jungian psychology, spirit is known as animus. These are identical. Animus. It gives a person firmness, direction, authority, a certain kind of wisdom and power. So I don't want to get into a trap, although I always fall into it, of speaking of this and falling on one side or the other. I'm sure you're going to hear me probably today emphasizing the soul, and the spirit will fall by the wayside. That's because I want to emphasize this. It's very hard not to get into that trap. But spirituality, obviously, and I don't think this audience needs any convincing, very important thing, part of human life. But it has its dangers. And at the same time, the soul also presents something important, the material to be seeded by spirit. Material. That may not seem too significant to you, but we need material. We need stuff in life to be seeded. Now, most of us get into this material without much trouble. The messes of life. The alchemists call this in Latin, a very obscure Latin phrase, massa confusa. I never have to translate that. And that is the stuff of soul, what the alchemists call the prima materia, the very primal, basic matter, the material that we have to work with. So soul provides this, and that's a very important gift of soul. Even though we don't like it, we don't like the mess, that is the gift of soul. So, painful relationships, silly obsessions, impossible loves, unrewarding work, moods of depression and hopelessness, addictions, somatic symptoms, all these wonderful things. This is the material that the soul provides, the stuff that the spirit can fertilize. But spirit is highly energized and doesn't like to be pulled down into these quicksands of the soul. I know that some of you are therapists and analysts. I'm sure you know what it's like when people are continually coming to you saying, how can I get rid of this? We're ridders, you know, you get rid of things all the time. We don't like this stuff. And if as an analyst you see the value of it and you try to hold it there for something to happen, it's not easy because there's such a strong fantasy of getting rid of these things. So a tension develops between our spiritual ideals and the demands of earthly life. We find clever, subtle spiritual ways out of the muck of the soul. It is not always easy to discern whether a spiritual move is a defensive maneuver, trying to get out of the soul, or actually an effective, heartfelt sorting out of the soul's complexity. Now, Renaissance philosophers and theologians, again my guide, warned that the worst condition possible is for the spirit and soul to be separated, each going its own way. Spirit can become dangerous. We can be seized in spirit. Now, this is what you might call a schizoid spirituality, not in touch with soul. This is the way Marsilio Ficino, a 15th century Italian Florentine, described it. Exactly like this way. You can have a split-off spirit, a split-off body, no soul, and you're in trouble. We can be seized in spirit by an idea or a cause or a way of life. These seizures can cause a person to commit suicide, as in Jonestown, to put a baby in an oven to burn the devil out of her, as would happen in St. Louis, to fight holy wars in which there is no feeling for human suffering, no sense of relatedness among the persons fighting each other. Now, maybe we don't usually think of spirituality in these things, but this Renaissance notion of spirit would be included also in these darker activities. Spirit can be unbelievably dangerous. That horn of the unicorn, so lovely when its shaft gleams like a steeple on a church, can also turn on its side and become a weapon. A 16th century text says the following about the unicorn. A warning we might put on the back of our unicorn greeting cards, the way we put warnings on cigarette packs. No one, it says, no one can tame this animal. He is so fierce, so full of guile. I'm going to try to do a unicorn card that way. It probably won't sell, but that's an important point that's left out. Soul, on the other hand, without spirit, can get lost in a meaningless life, in empty relationships, in hollow marriages, in alcohol, in food, in the amassing of wealth and things. The lion and the unicorn are in a perpetual struggle, giving us an image for the tension we may feel between the demands of the so-called flesh and the longing of the spirit. Now, one of the great questions of our time for religion and for psychology is how do we practice both our spirituality and our psychology so that they serve each other? As an analyst, I frequently see people for whom religious values stand in the way of their soul work. I've also known several people extremely sophisticated in the area of spirituality, yet when it comes to the simplest issues of the soul, they reveal surprising ignorance. It seems to me that attention to spirit can distract from necessary initiations into the mysteries of the soul. Let me give you an example that is a collage of several people. A woman who was raised in a strict Methodist family reaches a point in her life when her children have grown and left home, her husband has become complacent in his work, and their relationship stale. She has opportunities to explore the study of art, to take a new and exciting job, and to open herself up to a new group of friends. But she says that to do all this would be too selfish. She was raised to believe that a woman should be selfless. If you doubt this, I've heard this hundreds of times, this very story. I'm sure you have. Meanwhile, her dreams have become extremely sexual. For the first time in her life, she fantasizes having an affair with a business associate of her husband. She is shocked and disturbed by these dreams and daytime fantasies. But the more she tries to ignore them, the more insistently they press upon her. She never would have believed that in middle age she would suddenly change from being a pious, high-minded, devout religious person to somewhat obsessed with sex. It appears to me that this person is being visited by a spirituality that's foreign to her. Eros, desire, longing, and love has long been considered spiritual, a spirit. Eros appears sometimes under the natural disguise of sex, or mingled with sex. I didn't think this woman's desire aimed at an actual affair. She was being given the opportunity of finding new loves in her own heart. But her old, rigid spirituality would not tolerate movements of soul. It would keep her in a dry, painful marital state. She would rather obey the laws she memorized as a child than listen to the law in her own heart, the law of her nature. She had faith, she said, in her naive conception of religion, but not in life or in herself. She could find no trust in anything that was moving in her, so she resorted to the almost unlivable anxieties of willful suppression. It appeared to be bruising her soul. It seems to me that spirituality can mate with soul only when one influences the other, when one overlaps into the other. Renaissance teaching, as I said, holds that in a sense all three, body, soul, and spirit, can be imagined as in the embrace of soul. There can be a soulful approach to the body, a soulful approach to the spirit, a soulful approach to psychology. Sometimes we talk about psychological psychology to try to emphasize this aspect. If each is not itself soulful, it is schizoid, separated, autonomous, and generally negative. The teachings of the churches can offer a guide when we are faced with the demands and opportunities of our own fate, but they are a guide toward dealing with the ultimate movements one feels in one's own life and heart. Religious knowledge can weave with self-knowledge, or spiritual knowledge can interweave with soul knowledge, so that we recognize the profound mysteries at the very roots of our individual identities. Now back to Jung. In the discussion of the strife between the lion and the unicorn, Jung elaborates on this by mentioning a green lion, the green lion, who is pictured in alchemy with wide mouth devouring the sun. I have a picture of it here, but you can't obviously see it from but the lion is devouring the sun in this very ancient alchemical picture. The green lion swallows the sun and the blood is dripping. This is in color in the manuscripts. The green lion and bright red blood dripping down from the sun. Now, Jung interprets this image, interestingly, not in obvious ways. He says, this image represents the completion of the spirit's descent into matter. The completion of the spirit's descent into matter. See, he doesn't take it just negatively. Even though there's blood, even though we've got the lion's mouth wide open, he sees this as that spirit, the sun, finding its way into matter. Or, he says, it's the self-impregnation by one's own soul. Self-impregnation. The lion swallowing the sun, becoming pregnant with the sun. But at the same time, the sun being swallowed. You see what I mean? From a spiritual side, you might feel your spirituality being swallowed. Lion side, he's getting pregnant, or she's getting pregnant. You see, there's two things going on. It depends what where your sensitivities are as to what you're going to be feeling. Now, he uses several interesting words, other words from alchemy, to describe this process of the lion swallowing the sun. These probably don't need translation, but the first one is imbibitio, which means drinking. Imbibing. He says it's an imbibing. He needs a little blood. He's swallowing some blood. Think of that someday when you're going through a little afternoon dark night of the soul, a little eclipse of your spirit, a little depressive mood. The lion swallowing some of that spirit. Americans want to rush out all the time to get rid of depression. They never say they want to get rid of this great spirit, of happiness that can kill them too. We want to get rid of depression all the time. But see, here he's describing it as imbibing, imbibitio, the alchemist said, or cibatio, the eating, being eaten, our spirit being eaten. But if we're being eaten, if that spirit is being eaten, it is also nourishing something. The nutritio comes next, the nourishing. Penetratio, the soul being penetrated by the spirit. The great Christian image of this is the Virgin Mary, that the Annunciation, saying, fiat mihi, let it happen to me, when the Spirit is there making her fertile and pregnant. That's a digression. I will not get caught in. We don't have time for that. This is a mysterious image, this lion swallowing the sun, but it suggests that the green lion, that is, the soul when it feels alien, green as alien, little green men, the green alien soul, or the green as natural, the natural soul, when it is more natural than human, when its moods have us in a tight grasp, swallow our sunny dispositions, our solar values, the whole of our spirit. But Jung suggests this is a form of becoming pregnant. The woman I described found herself face to face with the green lion of her sexuality. By the way, sometimes this may not be a lion in your dreams. I've known of several cases where a person, I think, going through this very situation, I recall one dream where a woman is on a speedboat going across the lake, and suddenly the boat comes to a stop, and a huge snake appears, just the head of the snake appears in front of the boat. And she just stares at it, and it stares at her, and the dream ends. I think that's very similar to this. Having to face this green lion that we'd rather not face, or the snake. It threatens to swallow up, for this woman, all of her cherished family values. She says, but what about all the things I believed in since I was a kid? See, that's all being threatened by this appearance of the green lion. And, like David, she prayed, save me from the lion's mouth. But my sense was that to be swallowed by this lion, however painful, would be for her an incubation, the birth of something new in her, as though the lion's mouth were a kind of womb. So the lion, however, raw and untamed, threatened spirit. It's not so much that I am threatened by that I'm the one that's threatened by this lion, but my spirituality is threatened. With its particular ambitions and sensitivities, it's afraid of the lion. The powerful mysteries that lie at the base of any human life, sex, death, money, love, present themselves as challenges difficult to understand, impossible to get completely under control. Especially the person devoted to the unicorn, to the highest spiraling values feels tremors from these roaring lions. Maybe that's the same thing described as the shaking of the foundations, these tremors in the presence of that lion. Yet these unsettling mundane issues are the stuff of the soul, what the alchemist calls prima materia, the unformed material soul is made. Our very problems, then, are an opportunity. Symptoms are material for soul-making. In more ordinary terms, Jung's alchemical imagery is similar in concept to James Hillman's view that of its nature, the soul spontaneously and naturally pathologizes. Horrible word. But what it means is that spontaneously we have twisted images, weird dreams. So look at the history of art, what imagination has done. All of these, this kind of twisting of imagery. All the religious art, the Renaissance, the medieval art, you know, all these crucifixions, these hybrid animals that live on the roofs of cathedrals. These pathologized images, not meaning immoral or sick or anything like that, meaning just not natural, kind of taken out of that natural, wonderful state. So that's to say that our getting into trouble and falling into the mess of life may not be aberration. Maybe this is what life is about. And we would be misguided to try to avoid all mess through defensive moral stringency or too narrow a view of religion and the divine. When sunny views of life are eclipsed by the green lion of depression or trouble, that can be an impregnation by spirit. The gold of the sun is not gone, it is merely swallowed, taken in, momentarily invisible, incubating, finding a home within. Life is being internalized. Soul is being made. But spirit forges ahead at all costs. Religion dreams of utopias, sacred history aiming at some grand conclusion, holy Darwinism, Teilhardian Christic evolution. But the soul tends to regress. See, you know, spirit wants to go ahead, soul tends to hang on, going back. Dreams, the speech of the soul, take us back in time to former places and forgotten, if not buried, friends and relatives. The soul soaks in the past with no frenzy for the future. Imagine religion without a compulsive drive into the future. That is religion from the soul's point of view. The green lion swallows our sunny futurism. Its light goes dark, as in a depressive episode when the future doesn't seem, as we say about it, bright. Becoming saturated with the past, we work that raw material into insight, depth of reflection, and some honest wisdom. From the viewpoint of soul, the most important thing religion gives a person is not something to believe in. Now remember, I'm talking from the point of view of soul here, not speaking against belief. Not something to believe in, but rather a perspective that sees the sacred everywhere, theology in everyday life. And I don't mean to romanticize, just implying that everything in the world is precious and valuable and wonderful and holy. I mean that life cannot be grasped without a sensitivity to its deep mysteries. The daimonic figures that urge us from within toward our destiny, the wounds and gifts of the past that hang on for a lifetime, the family stories that just will never go away, the conflict between conscious ego plans and eruptions from down below. Religion can offer a perspective of sufficient depth to reach beyond personal motives to an archetypal basis of personality, to see this archetypal level of person. What the soul requires is sacred imagination, a means for perceiving the eternal in the temporal. Let me give you another example. A minister who has been through some very rough times has the following dream. He is in line at a cafeteria. Very common dream image. Cafeterias have done wonderful things for the soul and for dreams. He's in line at a cafeteria. After looking over all the food, and he sees that most of it is fruit mixed in with Jell-O, and he's not too happy about this. He spots a nice bowl of fresh fruit. And that's what he wants, this bowl of fresh fruit. But, as so often happens in dreams, suddenly he has to go to the bathroom. So, he has to urinate. So he runs off in search of the bathroom. Now, I can tell you, this is kind of, it's a comic thing. The soul stuff is more comic than tragic. But I tell you, this man is really living a tragic life. The dream reflects the comic side of it, but in his life, because of his limited vision, I think he only sees the tragedy. But here is someone, let me tell you, very painfully, painfully craving for a little bit of fresh fruit in his life after having all this jello stuff for 50 years. So this dream is very important to him. The dream, I would think, offers him a kind of communion this with freshness, this fresh part of life. But it reminds him of his need to deal with all the other material he needs to attend to and get out of his system. You know, in alchemy, I keep going back to that, for the alchemists, they said when you're going to go through the process of soul work, one of the best things you can put into the vessel, into the pot, is little boy's urine. And, you know, people look at that and they think, oh, this is weird. What are there? These sick people. But they're trying, I think, to show that this side of life, all that stuff that we reject, that aqua, that water, the fluidity of our lives, all of that movement in our life that is so unacceptable to us, has to go into the pot. I mean the pot of the alchemist. The pot that mixes up with all the other stuff that's going to be the stuff of the soul. Interesting insight those guys had and women had about this urine. Again, that's another digression. We could have a whole lecture on urine, but I don't think it came for that, so I'll pass that by. I think religion recognizes the mystery of this dream when it places rites of penance and awareness of one's faults before rites of communion. This is a very interesting, sacred, religious dream that this man has had. He's being reminded, you have to do your little ritual of penance first before you can eat your fresh fruit. It just won't work the other way. It's not that this is the way someone in the past figured out the services ought to be, have penance and then some kind of communion. This is the way the soul works. It's the nature of things. It's the very nature of things. Now, another man, this will be a more difficult one. I use this example now and then, and nobody agrees with me about it. So, another man who in life has severe problems with alcohol dreams that he is sitting in his third grade classroom. A little girl, his very first childhood love, comes to him and offers him a beautiful crystal glass containing a sparkling, beautiful, wonderful, amber-colored liquor. She invites him to drink it. He interprets it, maybe the way you're thinking, another temptation for alcohol. I don't see it that way. Everything in the dream points to the fact that this is a sacramental dream, that this man is being offered this very special alcohol in a very special container. This is a very alchemical dream. Emphasis on the container, the vessel, and emphasis on the beauty and color of the material, the liquid. And I would think that this dream is showing this man that he has not found the true alcohol. The alchemist calls water, their water, they said, is not H2O, it's the aqua permanens, the great water, the eternal water. In a sense, I suspect that this man is dreaming about the eternal alcohol that he can't get a hold of through that symptom. So, see what I'm saying? Here's the soul image, the deep mysteries that are contained within our symptoms. When we overlook the sacred in our social and individual symptoms, we treat our troubles with purely secular means. Alcoholism, like all addictions, is a theological matter. We should get the theologians out to work on this. Anorexia has deep theological roots. If you've ever worked with anorexia or if you've ever experienced it, you know it's a tremendously theological problem. Full of spiritual, religious, traditional imagery. Marital discord always reflects a problem in the hieros gamos. That means the sacred marriage. The inner sacred marriage of various differences that we feel within our souls. And to enter with imagination into marital mess might be to make contact with that inner marriage. You see, we don't want to get rid of the messes. We want to enter into them. The lion has swallowed something in a bad marriage. That doesn't mean that this is something we should try to get out of and get away from. Our dreams present us with images of our past as if they were of the present. Dreams are our sacred history, often revealing fragments of the eternal themes we know from institutional religion. A student once told me a dream in which he was swallowed by a huge fish and had to cut his way out. His family was sitting at a table in that fish. He said he never heard of Jonah and the whale or any story like that at all. This was his dream. What are you talking about, Jonah? Who's that? It was clear from the story of his life that indeed his soul was in that deeply interiorized place where he struggled with the family disturbances. But even the ordinary stories we tell place daily life within the realm of religion. They remind us how sacred the everyday is. A man and a woman fall in love. They go to a restaurant and have a fairly ordinary dinner. But in their love letters, this dinner turns into a time and place never to be forgotten. Eating becomes the Eucharist of their love. A mere restaurant, a sacred place. Coq au vin, the ambrosia of the gods. This example may seem superficial, but it isn't. Our ordinary rites of love touch the deepest levels of the soul's religion. I was going to tell a story. I think I'll skip an autobiographical one here. We're running out of time. I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit. I want to say something to you about morality. From the point of view of soul, morality is not a clear statement of right and wrong and the will to remain strictly faithful to such a statement. The soul is always labyrinthine, always in a maze, having many twists and turns and dark corners. To be faced with a moral dilemma or challenge is to enter more deeply in imagination into the issues involved. It is to be moved to explore the various mysteries that moral challenge offers, to find some wisdom at the base of a moral conflict, and then, finally, to achieve behavior that emerges from the heart with depth and security. Morality without soul betrays itself in the anxiety, defensiveness, and intolerance that surrounds it. For example, what if you were to consider the Ten Commandments? This is kind of a simple example. Less literally than usual, I might ask you, what were the Ten Commandments of your family? What are your Ten Commandments? What Ten Commandments are submerged are the shadows of your professed Ten Commandments or code of morality. What are your shadow Ten Commandments? What is the inverse underneath all those things you profess? What's the underneath of that? What negative laws do you follow? The poet William Blake explored this idea when he wrote his Proverbs of Hell. An example is, he says, prudence is a rich, ugly maid courted by incapacity. Not a very nice thing to say about prudence, but it's like a shadow commandment, the shadow devil proverb. Prudence is not always a virtue worth cultivating. A person can be so prudent as to never risk life. So Blake also said, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Which you wouldn't want to say every day of your life. You might want to say something else. But once in a while, the road of excess might lead to the palace of wisdom. So even in the case of morality, the green lion eats the sun. Bright, treasured moral convictions can get swallowed by compulsions. We are always hearing about politicians and other highly visible individuals who profess high-minded morality, but then get knocked on their moral bases and fall into a juicy scandal of sex, gambling, or embezzlement. But as an analyst, I would see value in that succumbing. The green lion, Jung says, impregnates himself when he devours the sun. Whenever we find our highly prized values devoured by some indomitable drive, that is an opportunity for the soul. The alchemist, by the way, recommended a whole series of vessels for this work. They had different shapes, and they had names for them, pelican and a whole bunch of other things. And one of the vessels they had was made, it was made so that when you put your stuff in the vessel, as I was suggesting earlier, things you might put in it, you put your stuff in there, you know, your problems at work and your problems with family, your memories of family life, all that stuff, you put it in there, and you heat it up a little bit, and you have some liquid in there, whatever you want to use, and as it heats up, they had this vessel designed so that it would go into another vessel and then come back. And back and forth. I mean, they would come around and make a circle. And they call this process, naturally, circulatio, the circulation. So this also is a way of looking at morality, perhaps. That instead of looking for this one fixed thing made out of iron, rather the moral issue goes into the pot, and the imagination then works with it, and it gets circulated. And circulated and circulated and refined and refined. And one develops then a moral imagination, not just a moral code, a moral imagination that has some depth and some sensibility. Okay, now we really are running out of time. I would like to finish up, though, with some suggestions of how we might, I'm not going to get any more practical, I'm not a very practical person, but get down to five more obscure, abstract suggestions of how we might get more of soul into our theology and our religion. Number one, this is all repetitious now. Number one, we could look with a cool eye at the shadows in our brilliant spirituality. Glimpsing shadow is always a therapeutic thing to do. When I work with therapists in training, we spend most of our time looking at their own shadows. I just spent a lot of time this summer working with therapists in training in Boston. And I just relentlessly looked at some of their shadows. You know, what about this money? What are your real thoughts about making money in this profession? What do you think about charging people for sitting there and talking to them, you know, for 50 minutes? And there's a lot of shadow in that. What about this erotic stuff, you know, about therapy? What about your feeling of being a charlatan, you know, that you're never going to get trained enough, you know, and you really can't help anybody? Is that true? Looking at the shadow can be very, very helpful. So much can erupt, can come up from that. So I think we can apply the same thing to spirituality. Look with a cool eye at the shadows in our spirituality, in those things we consider most important, to look at the shadow of them. But the shadow is not an easy thing to see, especially of the spirit. We might notice how we use our spirituality, for example, to avoid doubt, to avoid confusion and mystery, to get rid of mystery. That's why I worry about the word truth in regard to the spirit. To the fundamental anxieties of the human condition. We might notice those places in our religious attachments where we are the most defensive, the most touchy, the most insecure. That's a place for tremendous opportunity. You know, if we only can put that there and look at it, put that in a little glass vessel and look at it, those places of insecurity. Number two, we might look for our own myth in our stories of family and childhood. Not just taking those things literally and not just looking outside of ourselves for our mythology, but look to our own stories of our childhood, of our growing up, of our relationships, of our work. This is our mythology. They are a source of the soul's religion. In the same way we could take note of ordinary events, of dreams and daytime fantasies, of memories and wishes, all sources of the life of the soul. And third, we might look at the stories, figures, events, history, and tenets of our formal religion for their poetic nuances. To be at the level of soul is to look poetically always. A poetic sense serves religion. Whenever a person says that something is only symbolic, only imagistic, only poetic, that is the unicorn speaking. And you can tell them that. Is that a unicorn I heard? That's the unicorn gets worried about, anxious about these things. Not the lion, not the soul. Poetry is wonderful. It gives us depth and sensibility, sensitivity, imagination, subtlety. Number four, we might develop insight in religious lives instead of an only literal viewpoint that leads more to religious intolerance than to holy wisdom. A good sign that a person has achieved this depth of religious insight is good, solid humor, a profound, gentle awareness that human nobility, as Erasmus said, is wrapped in our foolishness. You can only have your nobility if you're willing to be a fool, says Erasmus. Only the clown dares walk close to the absurd paradoxes in human life, which, according to the 14th century theologian Nicholas of Cusa, are signs of the proximity of the divine. Cusa's word for an enlightened human being close to the divine was idiota. I don't have to translate that either, do I? Idiota, that is the person that he was aiming to be. And in fact, Cusa, in the 14th century, wrote a book called Ignorancia Docta, is that what it's called? Unlearned Ignorance, how to arrive at the point of unknowing. And fifth, we might find our way through the pricks of the unicorn and the roars of the lion, between the high reaches of our spirituality and the sharp teeth of life's disturbances. Pray to be saved from both, like David. Both are extremely dangerous, and at the same time, they're the only way. And now, finally, what I'd like to do is just mention someone who I think is one of our great theologians of our century, Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet. Sometimes called a poet, he's really a theologian. The poet Rilke, in a famous letter written in 1925, set out a theological project I understand as dealing with all of life with imagination rather than with heroic literalism. And here I want to close with just some words from this letter that Rilke wrote at that time. He says, "Our task is to stamp this provisional perishing earth into ourselves so deeply, so painfully and passionately, that its being may run invisibly in us. The earth has no other refuge except to become invisible in us, who through one part of our nature have a share in the invisible, or at least share certificates, and can increase our holding in invisible during our being here. We are the transformers of the earth. Our whole existence, the flights and plunges of our love, all fit us for this task."
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Anyone who would like to talk with Dr. Moore after this session will be meeting in room 740.